This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Audio Journal's Beyond the Pages. The book selections for this hour are designed for middle grade and high school listeners. This program is supported in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. My name is Lavender, and I'm happy to be with you today. I will continue reading from the book, When You Reach Me, by Rebecca Stead. Things You Give Away. I dropped the rolls back onto Colin's bag, pulled my coat on, threw my knapsack over one shoulder, and took the stairs two at a time. There was a mob of kids outside, like always, pushing and laughing and standing around talking, even though it was still freezing and had started to rain. I took a minute to look for Sal, like I always do. No sign of him. I wound Mom's scarf around my ears, turned north, and started walking up the hill to Anne Marie's. It didn't make sense. Not that Colin had taken the rolls. In fact, that was just the kind of thing I expected from Colin. But my brain was yelling all kinds of other questions at me. How could anyone possibly have known that Colin would take the rolls? And when had the note been put in my coat pocket? It didn't occur to me that you could have left it there the same day you put the first note in my library book about the squirrel village. I didn't get that at all until much later. And why me? I jumped a gutter full of rainwater and took the last steps to Anne Marie's building. Why was I the one getting notes? Why did I have to do something about whatever bad thing was going to happen? I didn't even understand what I was supposed to do. Write a letter about something that hadn't happened yet? Miranda, my brain said, nothing is going to happen. Someone is playing with you. But what if my brain was wrong? What if someone's life really needed saving? What if it wasn't a game? Anne Marie's doorman waved me in. Upstairs, her father answered the door with an unlit cigar in his mouth and asked me whether I wanted some cold noodles with sesame sauce. No thanks. Fizzy lemonade, then? He helped me tug my wet coat off. The lining was all stuck to my sweater. So I walked into Anne Marie's room, balancing my lemonade in an ice water for her, along with a dish of almonds that her father had somehow warmed up. Warm almonds sounds kind of yuck, but in reality, they taste pretty good. Anne Marie was still in her nightgown, but she looked normal. "My dad won't stop feeding me," she said, taking a handful of nuts. "And he won't let me get dressed. He says pajamas are good for the soul. Isn't that so dumb?" I sat on the edge of her bed. "Is that the rose?" It was on her bedside table in a tiny silver vase, just the kind of thing they would have at Anne Marie's house. She nodded and looked at it. The rose was perfect, just opening, like a picture in a magazine. "I tried to draw it," Anne Marie said. She held out a little spiral pad of heavy white paper. She'd sketched the rose in dark pencil, over and over. "Wow," I said. "I didn't know you could draw like that." She flipped the pad closed. "My dad shows me tricks sometimes. There are a lot of tricks to drawing. I can show you." But I knew I could never draw like that. For the same reason, I couldn't do Jimmy's V-cut or get my Main Street diagrams to look good. "Hey," I said, "maybe your dad left you the rose." "Maybe," she frowned, and I felt a little piece of myself light up. "He says he didn't, though." But it would explain how the person got upstairs, why the doorman didn't buzz you. I could feel my lips making a smile. Your dad is so nice. It has to be him. I was miserable, sitting on the edge of her bed in that puddle of meanness. But I couldn't help it. I didn't want Anne-Marie's rose to be from Colin. Maybe I couldn't stand for her to have so many people and to be able to draw and cut bread on top of that. Maybe I wanted Colin for myself. Anne-Marie's dad stuck his head through the doorway. Anybody need a refill? No, thanks, I said, even though my glass was empty and my back teeth were packed with chewed nuts. I have to go.
Stay for 5 minutes, he said. I put your coat in the dryer.
So I had to sit there, thirsty, and then I had to put on my dry, warm, but still dirty coat and take the elevator down to Anne-Marie's lobby, where the lamps glowed yellow and the doorman remembered my name. It had stopped raining. It was too cold for the boys to hang around in front of the garage. There was hardly anyone out on the street at all. The light in Belle's window looked friendly in the late afternoon gloom, and I thought of going in. I had been telling Belle the story of my book, a little bit here and a little bit there. I'd told her how Meg helped her father escape, and I'd described the first battle with IT, which is this giant evil brain that wants to control everyone. I knew Belle would give me some vitamin C's and maybe a paper cup of hot chocolate, but it was getting late and I didn't want to have to walk down our block in the complete dark, so I decided to keep going. At first, I thought the laughing man wasn't on the corner, but then I saw him sitting on the wet curb, leaning against the mailbox and just watching me walk toward him. For 1 second, there was something familiar about him, and I noticed for the first time how old he looked. I thought about what Louisa had said, about how old people can't get enough heat. Maybe I felt sorry for him. Maybe he reminded me of Mr. Nunzi from upstairs, or maybe I wanted to do something good, to make up for being kind of a jerk to Anne-Marie, even if she didn't really know it. Anyway, I spoke to him.
Hey, I said, opening my bag. You want a sandwich?
I still had the cheese sandwich I hadn't eaten at lunch. I held it out.
It's cheese and tomato.
Is it on a hard roll?
He sounded tired.
I can't eat hard bread. Bad teeth.
It isn't hard, I said. It was one of my best V-cuts ever, probably a little soggy now with the juice from the tomato soaking into the bread all afternoon. He reached up with one hand, and I put the sandwich in it.
What was the burn scale today? He asked.
I'm not sure, I said, pretending I knew what he was talking about.
I didn't have a chance to, check. Rain is no protection, he said, looking at the sandwich in his hand. They should have had the dome up.
Maybe tomorrow, I said. He looked up at me, and suddenly he seemed familiar again. It was something about the way his eyes took me in. He said,
I'm an old man, and she's gone now, so don't worry, okay?
I won't.
He nodded.
Smart kid.
Things that get stuck.
Guess what? I said to Mom when she got home. The laughing man isn't completely crazy. He's kind of a CSP.
CSP?
Crazy-shaped person.
Don't say crazy-shaped person. And what are you talking about?
I gave him a sandwich today. He was sort of normal about it. Almost.
You gave him a sandwich?
It was a leftover from Jimmy's.
Mira, why in the world would you give the laughing man a sandwich?
What's wrong with that? I thought you would like it.
You thought I would like the fact that you've struck up a relationship with a mentally ill person. What relationship? I just gave him a sandwich.
We've talked about this, Miranda. I thought you knew how to handle yourself. It's the only reason I let you walk around alone.
I just gave a sandwich to a homeless guy. You're the one who works for criminals and hangs around with pregnant jailbirds.
Not everyone accused of a crime is a criminal, you know. And besides, I'm not 12. I pointed at her sweatshirt, which had a rainbow on it.
Well, you dress like you're 12.
I could feel the tears starting. So I grabbed two bags of the chips Luisa had brought over, went to my room, and slammed the door. A few minutes later, she knocked and came in.
I'm sorry. You did a nice thing. I shouldn't have blown up at you like that.
Why did you then? She sat down on the bed next to me.
I don't know. I guess it made me nuts thinking you were putting yourself in danger. I like to tell myself that you're always safe, but there's no such thing, really, is there? I do trust you, Mira. I want you to know that. I don't want to make any more mistakes. I don't think I can bear to make one more single mistake.
What are you talking about? What mistakes? She laughed.
Are you kidding? Where should I start? I've made about a million mistakes.
Luckily, you outweigh almost all of them.
Almost all of them? Like how many? She smiled.
I don't know. 999,000.
So that just leaves, what, 1,000 to go?
Richard wants to move in, she said flatly. He wants us to get married. And my brain said,
he does?
Then I got this feeling of lightness.
I was happy.
That's great, I told Mom.
You think so?
She smiled for a second, and then her mouth dropped.
I don't know. I just can't. I can't figure out if it's the right thing.
Don't you love him?
Of course I do. I don't know if it's the right thing for you, I mean.
Is that why you won't give him a key? Because of me?
She shook her head slowly.
I don't know. I just feel stuck. Like, I'm afraid to take any steps in case they're the wrong ones.
I need a little more time to think.
She stood up. The water's probably boiling by now. Spaghetti in 10 minutes.
Spaghetti again. We were kind of stuck, I realized, in a lot of ways.
Tied up things.
You two have certainly gotten close, Mom said the following weekend while she helped me tug the rollaway cot from the overstuffed hall closet.
That's nice, right?
Anne Marie was sleeping over for the first time.
Don't you ever vacuum? I said. There's dust bunnies behind all the doors.
Give me a break, Mira, she said sharply.
I mean it. I saw a roach in the bathroom this morning. This place looks gross.
Mom glared at me.
A whole angry conversation seemed to pass over her face.
Then she said, you know what? Do this yourself, and walked away.
I pulled the cot into my room and lined it up next to my bed, the way Sal and I always had. Then I wondered whether that was the way other girls did it.
Was the cot supposed to be against the far wall? Should I make an L shape with my bed so that just our heads were together?
I decided on the L shape, stood back, adjusted the angle, and then went to get the sheets out of the bathroom closet.
Starting when we were really little, Sal and I used to beg to have sleepovers on the weekends, and lots of nights I fell asleep happy with Sal next to me on the rollaway. But he was never there in the morning. I would wake up and see the empty cot with its tumbled-up striped sheets, and Mom would tell me what had happened. He'd woken up with a stomachache or a headache or a bad dream and wanted to go home.
She'd hand me a tissue and say,
I don't know why we keep doing this. Sal cries in the middle of the night, and then you cry in the morning. A couple of weeks later, we would try again, and I always believed that this would be the time Sal would still be there in the morning. Eventually, we stopped trying, and then those striped blue sheets made me sad to look at. But they were the only ones we had that fit the cot. I tucked them in and went to Mom's room to take one of her pillows. She was still being angry in the living room. I fluffed the pillow, placed it carefully on the cot, and stood back. It looked okay. I was still standing there when the buzzer rang, and I got this clear mental picture of Anne Marie and her dad in our lobby with the cigarette smell and the ugly ceiling light full of dead bugs. It was like a vision almost. I went to the intercom and pushed the talk button. "Who is it?" her dad's voice. "It's Anne Marie and her unshaven father." I buzzed long and hard in a way that was supposed to say, "You are extra welcome to be here." Also, the lobby door is so heavy, I wanted to give them time to get it open. Mom came and stood next to me by the front door, saying nothing and running her fingers through her hair. She was wearing jeans and had changed her t-shirt for a black turtleneck sweater. It was at that moment, standing next to her, that I figured out the truth. The truth was that Mom saw it too. The peeling paint, the cigarette butts on the stairs, everything. It soaked into me like water into sand, fast and heavy making. But I still couldn't apologize for what I'd said. I wanted to, but I couldn't. I couldn't even smile at her. "Welcome," Mom sang to Anne Marie's dad. "I'm so glad Anne Marie can spend the night with us." Anne Marie's dad had a cardboard box full of stuff, little containers and plastic bags which he offered to Mom. "I'm sure Miranda's mentioned that Anne Marie eats a special diet," he started.
"Oh?"
Mom looked at me. "Actually, never fear." He pushed the box at her again. "I've brought all sorts of appropriate goodies. Feel free to sample them yourself. They're not bad, if I do say so myself." Mom smiled and took the box.
"That's wonderful. Thanks. Had I known..."
"Never fear," Anne Marie's dad said again. I saw that the things inside were tied up with purple and green curly ribbon, like Christmas presents. Anne Marie and I played some records in my room, and Mom brought in a special platter with Anne Marie's snacks on it and a bowl of chips for me, and then we watched TV in the living room for a while before bed. We were watching Love Boat when we heard something hit the kitchen floor, followed by a bunch of cursing from Mom. A minute later, she popped her head in and looked at Anne Marie.
"Sorry, you didn't hear that, okay? I dropped some frozen grape juice on my foot."
Anne Marie smiled a wide smile.
"No problem. Your mom is so cool," she said later when we were in our beds and her face was resting on Mom's pillow. "I like her a lot. She's like a real person, you know, and she treats you like a real person too. My dad still acts like I'm a baby."
"I guess. But who wants to be treated like a real person?" I thought. I wanted to be treated like Anne Marie and have all my snacks tied up with ribbon. When I opened my eyes in the morning, Anne Marie was still there. I felt this big rush of relief, like I'd been worrying all night that she would disappear. Maybe I had been without realizing it.
"Thank God you're awake," she said, her head propped up on one arm. "I've been poking you for 20 minutes. You sleep like the dead."
"What time is it?" I asked, throwing off my blanket.
"Time to eat," she said. "I'm starved."
"Can you eat cereal?" I asked.
"All I know is how to make cereal and toast."
"Nope," she said.
Can't eat either one. Got any eggs? We went to the kitchen to check. Good morning. Mom was standing in front of the stove making bacon. Anne-Marie, I called your dad last night and he told me that you have a thing for bacon omelets. Yum, Anne-Marie said. That smells great. No wonder I'm so hungry. I was staring. Mom had serious bedhead and her eyes were puffy with sleep. But she was up at 7:30 in the morning making us bacon omelets. I wanted to hug her, but didn't. Things that turn pink. It snowed a little on the second to last day before Christmas vacation. Snow always puts me in a good mood. Mr. Tompkin let us skip the math workbooks and spend the whole morning on our Main Street projects. Anne-Marie helped me start my swings. So far, the perfect day. By the time we walked to Jimmy's, the snow had stopped and the sidewalk was just slushy enough to make my sneakers uncomfortably wet. Mom had slept through the weather report, so I was the only one without boots. Colin started to push open Jimmy's door, but Jimmy jumped out from behind the counter and leaned against the door so it slammed in our faces. Hey! Colin smiled, thinking it was a joke, and shoved back. But I could see Jimmy's face better than Colin could. It wasn't a joke. Get out! Jimmy called through the glass. Don't come back here anymore! You're lucky I don't call the police! Anne-Marie put her hand on Colin's shoulder. I think he's serious. What? Colin saw our faces and then looked up at Jimmy through the door. What's going on? He yelled. Jimmy had one foot up against the bottom of the door. He glared at us. Some people on the street looked over, but nobody stopped. Somebody stole my bank, he said finally, his voice sounding far away. One of you. Of course we told him through the door that we didn't, that we wouldn't, but there was no way he was letting us in. We went to the pizza place and talked about who could have taken Jimmy's $2 bills. He ran the place alone, aside from the 40 minutes a day that we were there. Maybe someone had run in while he was in the bathroom, we thought. He usually put his back in 5 minutes sign in the window and locked the door, but not every time. Sometimes he just ran into the back for a minute, and if someone came in, they waited. Someone could have taken the bank then, but who in the world would have known to take it in the first place? It was a faded plastic bank in the shape of a cartoon child. It didn't look remorselessly valuable. Let's write him a letter, Anne-Marie said. Or no, we'll get him a card. She used her spoon to scrape up the last of her lunch, which her dad packed for her every day in a cleaned-out yogurt container. Come on, she said, standing up. It'll be my treat. So we went into Gold's Stationery and bought Jimmy a greeting card. I wanted to get one that said, "With sympathy," for Jimmy's lost bank, but Anne-Marie said we should pick something that was blank inside. She picked a card with roses on it, which I thought was kind of strange, considering it was for Jimmy and roses are supposed to symbolize love. She said the card looked sincere, but I guessed that she liked it because it reminded her of her mystery rose. What do you think? She asked Colin. She held up the card in front of him. Colin raised his shoulders and dropped them. I guess. Anne-Marie said nothing, but she looked like she'd been hoping for a more revealing answer. Can you put this on my dad's account? She asked the cashier. Sure thing, Anne-Marie. Hey, where's your pal Julia? Home sick today? Anne-Marie turned pink. No, she's around. The cashier smiled and handed Anne-Marie a spiral notebook with a beaten-up cover. Anne-Marie flipped it open and wrote her name and the date. A charge account at Gold's. I thought of the fact I thought of the fat, smelly markers that cost $2.50 each, the leather diaries that locked with little keys, the battery-operated fans that you could wear on a string around your neck on hot days. "Hey, Anne-Marie," Colin said, "want to buy me a pack of baseball cards?" She turned pink again. "I can't. I mean, I'm not allowed. Sorry." He shrugged and smiled. "No big deal." Sometimes I wanted to squeeze Colin's cheeks until his teeth fell out. After school, Anne-Marie and I went to her house. Her dad brought us some weird kind of thin ham rolled up so we could eat it with our fingers. We wrote on Jimmy's card, "Dear Jimmy, we did not take your Fred Flintstone bank. We don't know who could have taken it. Maybe someone came in when you went to the bathroom. Can we come back to work? Signed, your employees, Anne-Marie, Miranda, and Colin." I put the card in my knapsack so that I could slip it under Jimmy's door the next morning on my way to school. Then we lay on Anne-Marie's rug and planned all the stuff we were going to do over Christmas vacation. Anne-Marie wanted to start teaching me how to draw, even though I told her I was probably hopeless and we were going to go to the movies, and her dad even said he would take us ice skating in Central Park. I tried not to wonder what Sal would be doing. I figured he'd be playing basketball right up until the first big snow. Things that fall apart. The next morning, on my way to school, I pushed our card under Jimmy's locked door. At lunchtime, Colin, Anne-Marie, and I walked up to Broadway together. Jimmy was helping a customer, but he saw us through the glass door, made a face, and shook his head no. "I guess he means it," Colin said. We stood there in front of the door for a minute, just in case. When the customer left with his sandwich, Jimmy glanced over at us again. Colin put his hands together under his chin like he was praying and made a puppy dog face, which was a dumb joke, but also pretty cute. Jimmy took a rag and started wiping down the counter, and then he raised one arm and waved us in without looking up. "So we can come back to work?" Colin asked when we'd all crowded in the door. Jimmy looked at us. "You're good kids," he said, "but you don't know what you're doing half the time." "We didn't take the bank," I started, and he waved at me to be quiet. "I know. I've been thinking about it. You can come back to work." "Yay!" Anne-Marie started clapping. Colin ran around slapping everyone five, including Jimmy, who even smiled. "But here's the thing," Jimmy said after Colin had taken a victory lap behind the counter and through the back room. "Your friend, little Swiss Miss, don't let me find her in here again, ever."
"Who?"
Anne-Marie said.
"I think he means Julia."
"I think Julia took the money," Colin laughed.
"Julia needs money like a fish needs a bicycle."
Jimmy shook his head. "Some things are in the blood. All the money in the world can't change a person's blood."
"What do you mean, blood?"
Anne-Marie had her hands on her hips.
"What blood?"
Jimmy pointed his big finger right at me.
"Like you call her, Swiss Miss. Hot chocolate."
"Huh?"
Colin looked at me and back to Jimmy. I was just getting it. Anne-Marie was way ahead of me.
You pig," she said. "You racist pig!"
I had never seen Anne-Marie angry. She was scary and also obviously about to cry. Jimmy shrugged.
"It's your life. I'm not having that little thief back in here. You don't have to come back either."
"I won't!"
Anne-Marie shouted, and she banged out the door.
"And that's not why I call her Swiss Miss," I said.
Jimmy shrugged again, and I banged out after Anne-Marie. Colin followed me. We found her crying halfway down the block, walking fast. She was spitting words.
That big, fat jerk! That pig! I hate him!
Colin looked at me. I don't even get what just happened.
Anne-Marie whirled around to face us.
He thinks Julia did it because she's black!
No way, Colin said. He's crazy.
Anne-Marie turned on me then.
Is that your name for her, Swiss Miss?
No, I said it one time, but I meant about how she's always talking about Switzerland. Her watch and the chocolate and...
She is?
Colin asked. I never heard her talk about Switzerland.
If anyone needs the money, Anne-Marie said to me coldly, it's you, not Julia.
Are you serious? I didn't take the stupid money.
Forget it, she said. I want to be alone.
And she stomped off towards school. Colin raised his eyebrows after her and then showed me a rolled up dollar.
Want to get a slice?
So we went to the pizza place. But it wasn't fun. And walking back to school, it occurred to me that Colin might not like me at all.
He might just like pizza.
Tell me something, I said, just before we got to our classroom. That day the bread count was short by 2 rolls. Did you take them?
Yeah, Colin said, starting to smile. I thought it would be, hey, I didn't steal Jimmy's bank, you know.
He looked at me through his bangs with his injured He looked at me through his bangs with his injured puppy face.
I know, I said quickly. I know you wouldn't. The rolls were just for fun, he said. But taking the bank would be, you know, stealing.
Yeah. I didn't get to talk to Anne-Marie all the rest of that afternoon. After a silent reading period, she went to art and music, and I went to gym and science. And then some of the kindergartners came to our classroom to sing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And then it was Christmas vacation.
Christmas vacation.
For 3 days in a row, the sky was like a dusty white sheet. I thought about calling Anne-Marie, but didn't. I thought about calling Colin, but didn't. I was right about Sal. He was playing basketball every day, and a couple of times there were the voices of other boys, kids from school. On the third day, I opened our living room window very quietly and watched them running up and down the alley in their knit hats with steam blowing out of their mouths. Then I sat on the couch and closed my eyes. I pictured the world. I pictured the world millions of years ago, with crazy clouds of gas everywhere and volcanoes and the continents bumping into each other and then drifting apart. Okay, now life begins. It starts in the water with tiny things, microscopic, and then some get bigger. And one day, something crawls out of the water onto land. There are animals, then humans, looking almost all alike. There are tiny differences in color, the shape of the face, the tone of the skin, but basically they are the same. They create shelters, grow food, experiment. They talk, they write things down. Now fast forward. The Earth is still making loops around the sun. There are humans all over the place, driving in cars and flying in airplanes. And then one day, one human tells another human that he doesn't want to walk to school with her anymore.
Does it really matter? I asked myself. It did. I tried again. I pictured the world, all pretty blue-green and floating out in space, creatures and forests and deserts and cities. I brought North America into focus, the United States, the East Coast, New York City. Kids are walking down the street toward school. One kid has green suede boots. One has a charge account at Gold's. One has keys in her pocket. Does it really matter? I asked myself. It did. I got up, turned on the television, and tried to think about nothing for a change. The second proof. Mom didn't have to work on Christmas Eve day. We got a tree and strung popcorn for it, and she had some friends from work over. Richard made some eggnog from a German recipe his grandmother made him, and they all ended up singing a lot while I wrapped presents in my room. I had bought Mom a pair of earrings, a bottle of purple nail polish with glitter in it, and some striped tights, even though I thought, and I still think, that striped tights look dumb. I got Richard an erasable pen from Gold's. On Christmas morning, we opened presents first thing after Mom made coffee, like always. I got some good stuff, a beaded bracelet, a portable radio, a fancy journal to write in with clouds on the cover, a sweater, and a tin of these really crispy finger cookies I love from a bakery near Mom and Richard's office. We were just about to move on to pancakes when Richard handed me a hard rectangular package that had to be a book. Let me guess, I said. A book? I wondered if it would be the kind with a spunky girl on the cover. Very funny. Open it. It was a book. Actually, it was my book. But this was a hardcover one with a different picture on the front. I read the title out loud, A Wrinkle in Time, and then I smiled at Richard. It's a first edition, Richard said. Richard! Mom burst out. You shouldn't have! This made me guess that first editions are expensive. Read what's inside, he said. I had the author sign it for you. Oh! I opened the front cover. The writing was big and swoopy beautiful. Nothing like yours. Miranda, Tesser Well, Madeline Langle. Christmas Day. Tesser Well, your second proof. It wasn't a game, I realized. Holding that book in my hands, I finally believed that whoever wrote me those notes actually knew about things before they happened, somehow. As soon as Richard and Mom went to make the pancakes, I ran to my room and took all your notes out of the box under my bed. I am coming to save your friend's life and my own. Coming from where? I asked myself. Coming from when? I was beginning to believe that someone I cared about was in real danger. But I still didn't know who it was, and I still didn't know how to help. I looked at the second note. I know you have shared my first note. I ask you not to share the others, please. I do not ask this for myself. That was the worst part. I was alone. Things in an elevator. New Year's Day was weirdly warm and sunny. Sal's basketball was going strong by about 9 in the morning. I sneaked a look down into the alley and saw him running back and forth in just a t-shirt and a pair of sweatpants. He was wearing the watch Louisa had given him for Christmas. She'd come up to show it to us beforehand. It was kind of old-fashioned, with Roman numerals and a leather band, and I hadn't been sure Sal would like it, but it looked like he did. Mom was sleeping late. I wrote her a note. I went out. I'll get you a bagel. The laughing man wasn't on the corner. Maybe he didn't work holidays. Bell's was closed. Everything felt kind of peaceful and sad and deserted. My feet carried me to school, which was closed, of course. The yard gate was open, and I went in and sat on the jungle gym for a few minutes, letting myself feel how strange it was to be there alone. I was sort of deliberately trying to weird myself out, I think, to get my energy up. To call Anne-Marie. 10 days of silence had grown into a question that my brain shouted inside my head. Is Anne-Marie even your friend anymore? There was a payphone on the corner. I had a dime in my coat. As I dialed, I noticed someone leaning over the garbage can across the street. When he pulled himself upright, I saw it was the Laughing Man. He stood there with his hands on his hips, looking down at the garbage. I quickly turned my back to him, worried that he might recognize me and come over. The receiver of the payphone was cold against my ear. Only after it started ringing did it occur to me that if my mother was sleeping, Anne-Marie's parents might be sleeping too.
"Hello," Anne-Marie's dad answered the phone.
He sounded as if he'd been up for hours, just sitting by the phone and hoping it would ring.
"Hi, it's Miranda."
"Hi, Miranda. Happy New Year."
"Happy New Year to you, too. I was wondering if Anne-Marie is there."
"She is, but she's in the shower. Are you by any chance outside, Miranda? It sounds like you might be at a payphone."
"Oh, yeah, I am, actually."
"In the neighborhood?"
"Yeah, I'm right by school."
"Well, come on over. I'm pouring you some orange juice right now."
Okay.
"You can surprise Anne-Marie."
"Would I ever?" I walked up the hill where the sunlight seemed to touch everything like it was a hyper kid running all over a toy store. It bounced off the dirty metal lampposts like shiny brass awning posts, even the sunglasses of a woman walking her dogs with a cup of coffee in one hand. Everything shined.
"Miss Miranda, Happy New Year," Anne-Marie's doorman was standing just outside the building's polished doors.
He smiled and waved me in. On the way up, it hit me that it was truly strange to come over here without talking to Anne-Marie first. But at the exact same time, I got nervous about that. I also got this other feeling, which I can only describe as love for Anne-Marie's elevator. The wood paneling, the cloth-covered stool in one corner, the little bell that went off every time we passed another floor. It was all so nice and cozy that I thought it would be wonderful to stay inside it forever, or at least to sit down on the little stool and close my eyes for a while. The whole thing was beyond weird. And then the elevator stopped on Anne-Marie's floor, and of course I got out because that's what people do when the elevator gets to their floor. Anne-Marie answered the door in her robe with wet hair.
"Hi," I started. "I just called to say Happy New Year, and your dad said..."
She smiled.
"Come on in."
It was the best morning. Anne-Marie showed me her Christmas presents. She got all kinds of cool art stuff, and we ended up spreading it all over the dining room table and drawing comic strips on this special comic strip paper that came with stickers for the talking bubbles and the thinking bubbles. And then her mom showed us how to make origami frogs, and I was actually good at it. Meanwhile, her dad kept bringing in these plates of bacon, and for me, French toast strips I could pick up with my hands. Then Mom called. I had completely forgotten about her. She was frantic, she was angry, and she was coming to get me. Even Anne-Marie's dad looked mad.
"Better get your coat on," he said when I hung up the phone,
even though my mom couldn't possibly get to Anne-Marie's apartment that fast. So I waited by the door, overheating in my coat, and Anne-Marie waited with me.
"So, about what happened at Jimmy's," I said. "You know,
I really never meant what he thought I meant. Not for one second. She looked at the floor. I totally believe you, and I don't know why I said that thing I said about money. It was stupid. It's okay. I was so grateful that she had something to apologize for that it didn't really occur to me to think about how it had actually made me feel. But I have thought about it since then. It didn't make me feel good. We heard the elevator's ding, and I opened Anne-Marie's front door before Mom had a chance to ring the bell. I thought I might be able to escape without Anne-Marie's parents talking to her. No such luck. Jerry, Mom called out, and Anne-Marie's dad came rushing over saying, Oh, you're here. I didn't hear the bell. I'm so sorry about this, Mom said. No, I'm sorry. I had no idea. It'll never happen again. Always check with you first. They cross-talked for a while, then hit one of those natural breaks in the conversation and both turned to look at me. Let's go, Mom said coldly, and I said, Thanks for having me, and Anne-Marie's dad smiled at me, but only because he's the nicest person on earth. The elevator opened right away, so there was no awkward waiting. On the way down, I knew I should apologize, but I just waited for Mom to jump all over me. Instead, she burst into tears, which made me cry. So we both cried through the lobby, past the doorman, and out into the sunlight, where we magically stopped. She took a deep breath and looked at me. I was scared, she said. When you didn't come back, I got really scared. Don't ever do that again. I nodded. Okay, she said. What now? I don't know. Maybe a movie? So that's what we did. We went to the movies and ate candy and popcorn and held hands for a few minutes on the way home. The laughing man was at his regular post, doing his kicks in the street. When he saw us, he yelled, Smart kid! But having Mom there made it different, like walking down the street with a blanket wrapped tight around me. Richard was leaning up against our building, reading a newspaper. Hey, he said, we had a plan. Did you forget about me? He made a sad face, and Mom said, Oh, no. How late am I? And then she looked at me, and we both started laughing. Richard said, Seriously, would it kill you to give me a key? And Mom shrugged and said it was only 3:30, and she didn't much feel like going upstairs anyway. So we turned around and went to eat at the diner, which was full of people just waking up and having breakfast. Things You Realize. It was 1979, a new year. A new decade, almost, but school was still just school. Jay Stringer was still a genius, music assemblies were still boring, and Alice Evans was still too shy to admit when she had to go to the bathroom. The fourth grade's violin performance had only just started, and already Alice was squirming in her seat next to me. Jay was on my other side, somehow reading a book while listening to the world's worst music. I located Sal's blonde head a few rows ahead on my right. I stared at the back of it for a while, trying to see if I could make him turn around with the sheer power of my brain waves, but it was hard to concentrate with Alice doing a Mexican hat dance in her chair. I tried to make a face at Anne-Marie, who was on the other side of Alice, but Anne-Marie seemed fully absorbed by the music. She's extremely non-judgmental that way. So I went back to looking at Sal. Directly in front of me was Julia. She was obviously as bored as I was. Her head kept bobbing around. And then she turned and looked at Anne-Marie. I glanced over and saw that Anne-Marie's eyes were still on the stage. Julia watched Anne-Marie, and I watched Julia watching Anne-Marie. And what I saw were eyes that were 60% cacao chocolate, a face that was café au lait, and an expression that was so familiar it made my whole body ring like a bell. Julia's look was my look. My looking at Sal. And suddenly, I knew three things. First, it was Julia who had left the rose for Anne-Marie. Second, Julia cared about Anne-Marie, but Anne-Marie didn't see it, because I was standing in the way. Third, Alice Evans was about to pee in her pants. I turned to Alice. "Hey," I said, "I have to go to the bathroom. Be my partner?" Sometimes you never feel meaner than the moment you stop being mean. It's like how turning on a light makes you realize how dark the room had gotten. And the way you usually act, the things you would have normally done, are like these ghosts that everyone can see but pretends not to. It was like that when I asked Alice Evans to be my bathroom partner. I wasn't one of the girls who tortured her on purpose, but I had never lifted a finger to help her before or even spent 1 minute being nice to her. She stopped squirming and looked at me suspiciously. "You have to go?" she said. "Really?" "Yeah." And in that moment, I wanted nothing as much as I wanted Alice to feel safe with me. "Really?" I leaned forward in my seat and waved my arm up and down so that Mr. Tompkin turned to look at me from his seat at the end of the row, and I spoke over the laps of Jay Stringer and Colin, who were sitting between us. "I have to go to the bathroom." These words felt like some kind of sacrifice, a precious offering to the universe. I didn't know why, but Julia's look had given me this total determination to get Alice Evans to the bathroom before she wet herself. "Now?" Mr. Tompkin whispered. "Please." He rolled his eyes. "Fine." Mr. Tompkin tilted his knees to one side to let us pass, and Jay Stringer and Colin put their heads together, and then Jay laughed. My mind processed that if Jay was the one who'd laughed, then Colin was the one who'd made the joke. A joke about me, maybe. I grabbed Alice's hand and pulled her after me, and then we were running up the aisle. Things You Beg For. As soon as Alice went into the bathroom, I ran down the hall toward the office. There were so many things I wanted to do but couldn't, like hug my mom or be less jealous of Anne-Marie, and I didn't want this to become one of them. But I had to work fast. "Miranda?" Wheelie looked up at me doubtfully. "Aren't you supposed to be in assembly?" "Yes, I am in assembly. I mean, I was, and I'm going right back. Alice is in the bathroom. Can I have a piece of paper?" "No, ma'am, I don't have paper to be just giving away." "Please, just a little piece, a corner of a piece." If I didn't do this now, I never would. Wheelie sighed. Then, still in her chair, she kicked her way over to the next desk, where there was one of those pink message pads. She ripped off the top sheet, folded it again, and then carefully ripped the paper along the first fold, and then along the second fold. "Hurry," my brain said. "Hurry!" "Here," she held out a quarter of a pink message slip and looked at me with a face that said, "I hope you won't be coming around here looking for another handout anytime soon." I picked up a pen from the counter and scribbled on the little pink square. "I thought you left me." Alice was standing in front of the bathroom, looking all wounded. "Me?" I said. "No way." She smiled. People seemed to like the new me. We squeezed back into our row past Colin and Jay Stringer, who whispered and laughed again. Anne-Marie leaned forward and gave me a where-were-you shrug. I mouthed, "The bathroom," and she nodded and settled back again. I folded my pink square a couple of times. Then I leaned forward and dropped the note into Julia's lap. I hadn't had much time. It was just the one word, truce. And underneath, I'd written my phone number. Well, folks, that's all the time we have for today. This Young at Heart program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I hope you will join us next time for Young at Heart. If you have any ideas or comments, we'd love to hear from you. I'm Lavender. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. Look high into the top branches of a tall tree, and you may see the source of this call, a bald eagle. Yes, that squeaky door sound comes from the official bird of the United States of America. Sitting about 3 feet tall, this majestic bird has a wingspan of more than 6 feet. Stretch your arms as far as you can, and imagine a bird whose reach is even greater. Mature bald eagles have snowy white heads and tails, and powerful dark brown bodies. Their eyes, beaks, and taloned feet are shades of bright orange and yellow. Immature bald eagles, on the other hand, look so different that early ornithologists thought they were another species entirely. Young bald eagles are a patchwork of dark mottled colors, and their eyes, feet, and beaks are drabber shades of gray, brown, and yellow. It can take young eagles up to 4 years before they grow into their iconic adult colors. Even with a call that sounds like a rusty gate, the bald eagle is lord of the landscape. Go eye to eye with a bald eagle when you come to our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Audio Journal, the radio reading service of Central Massachusetts, serving visually and print-impaired listeners since 1987. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
Gloria Goodbody stepped up to the bar, leaned over, and whispered into Harold the bartender's ear that she wanted a tall, cool glass of water. Instead of granting her request, Harold reached under the bar, pulled out a shotgun, and pointed it directly at Gloria. A moment later, a smiling Gloria gave Harold a huge kiss and a large tip as a token of her appreciation. Why would Gloria be thanking Harold for his strange behavior?
And here's the solution to our mystery.
Gloria had been battling a bout of hiccups, and Harold, being an experienced bartender, knew that scaring her would prove infinitely more effective than a glass of water. It evidently worked.
And now back to our regular programming.
What's your vision?
My vision is 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye, zero vision in the left eye.
No, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work financially independent.
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, we believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.